the good news that over 15 years from 2000 to 2015, 1.5 billion people gained access to basic drinking water services. The flip side of this is, however, the bad news that we still, in 2020, have about 2.3 billion people who don't have access to safe sanitation. So that is one of the SDGs that is badly off track.
Hello, and welcome to The Evaluator, a podcast by the Independent Evaluation Unit, IEU, of the Green Climate Fund, GCF. I'm your host, Yeonji Kim, Communications Officer at the IEU. The IEU aims to conduct evaluations that will help make the GCF faster, smarter, and better. We are committed to collecting and producing high-quality evidence to inform policymaking within the GCF and the broader international climate finance arena that translates into better outcomes on the climate action front. The Evaluator brings you compelling insights on cutting-edge topics related to evaluation, climate action, and development, featuring experts from across the globe as well as from within the IEU. Today's episode features Dr. Anya Grubitsky, Deputy Director of External Affairs at GCF. Dr. Grubitsky is a global expert in anaerobic wastewater to energy conversion, with nearly 40 years of engineering experience. Previously, she served as Executive Secretary of the Global Water Partnership and also as Deputy Secretary General of the Ramsar Convention on Wetlands. She was one of the coordinating lead authors of the Freshwater Chapter of the UN Environment's 6th Global Environment Outlook Report, subtitled Healthy Planet, Healthy People. In this podcast, she talks about the global water cycle and especially the state and trends of fresh water worldwide, as reflected in this UNEP report. First, a few words from Dr. Grubitsky about the UN Environment's Global Environment Outlook.
This is the most comprehensive global assessment of the world's environment, based on a number of regional assessments that were done before this was completed. We're looking to put forward a vision of a sustainable world in 2050, and based on the 5 main environmental themes of air, land, freshwater, oceans, and biodiversity.
UNEP's 6th Global Environment Outlook Report, or GO6 in short, won the prestigious award for environmental science by the Association of American Publishers in 2020. So congratulations to all the authors, funders, and supporting organizations. So why is GO6 subtitled Healthy People, Healthy Planet? Well, for those of us currently living in a COVID-stricken world, the fact that planet health is closely linked to our own health will not catch us by surprise. The health of our planet, including that of freshwater ecosystems, is vital and a precondition for healthy people. And GO6 makes this point saliently, based on evidence.
First of all, there's a focus on health. And this was somewhat prescient, of course, because this whole assessment started back in 2018, in fact, 2017, long before COVID. But we're seeing now this message loud and clear that without a healthy planet, we're not going to have healthy people. And of course, fresh water is central to all of this, because without fresh water, it's very difficult to wash your hands and keep yourself free of infection. The messages are strongly grounded in science, with the most recent data and peer-reviewed literature, but combing through literature from all the regions, as well as the global literature. So this was the reason for the process of the regional GOs preceding the global GO.
Fresh water, as its name implies, is generally characterized by having low concentrations of dissolved salts and other total dissolved solids. Fresh water may include water in ice sheets, ice caps, glaciers, icebergs, ponds, lakes, rivers, streams, and even underground water. Dr. Grubitsky says GO6 communicates one significant shift in thinking about fresh water. And that is, Fresh water is a global public good, and at the same time, it is a risk multiplier that affects the human and ecosystem health.
We have now made this shift to arguing that fresh water as a risk multiplier is very significant. So what is happening? We're seeing major changes in the global water cycle, which is really integrating all the interactions and impacts both on land, in water, in the oceans, in the atmosphere. And all of these numerous interactions and impacts are adding up to an acceleration of the global water cycle. We have both population growth and climate change as increasing the water-related risks, and I'll show you how both of those also disaggregate into the drivers of economic development, agriculture, deforestation, urbanization, transport corridors, land degradation, how all of these can contribute to increasing these water-related risks. As you know, as an example of these anthropogenic risks, we're seeing pathogens, toxic chemicals and plastics increasingly polluting fresh water in many of the regions with the downstream impacts on oceans. And of course, because of climate change, we're seeing, as the IPCC predicted back in 2008, we're seeing more frequent and more severe storms, floods, and droughts. The desertification of land is intensifying, rainfall patterns are changing, and the snow caps are melting.
Simply put, climate change is accelerating the global water cycle, which leads to multiple changes in rainfall patterns, putting pressure on freshwater ecosystems. One glaring example of this, highlighted in GO6, is the catastrophic shrinkage of Lake Chad, which has lost 90% of its surface area, with an enormous loss of its associated biodiversity, including fish, and loss of livelihoods for the millions of people dependent on the lake.
We've seen a loss of 90% of the surface area of this major freshwater inland water body. And when we look at the causes, we find that about 50% of the causes can be attributed to increased human water use and increased populations. But the other 50% is attributable to climate change. This is leading to increased resource conflicts over land, water, and fisheries. There are many millions of people who live in the basin of Lake Chad with a number of countries around. And indeed, millions of people's livelihoods are being affected. And GCF has a number of projects which aim to address some of these impacts. But I'd like to talk here a little bit more about how the disappearance of a freshwater body like this drives changes in the local microclimate. So water has a very high heat capacity. And so the presence of a large water body acts to stabilize temperatures. The water is absorbing the heat during the day, and it releases the heat at night. So you're not getting such large diurnal fluctuations. As the water volume decreases, obviously, the water body is less able to play this sort of buffering role. And so you start seeing much larger temperature fluctuations. You're starting to get much higher extreme temperatures. And then this becomes a reinforcing cycle. This also then leads to less rainfall because a warmer atmosphere above the water body is going to take longer to be able to produce rain. Sometimes that moisture-laden air can get blown away and the rain would actually fall in another basin, not back in the basin where from where the water has evaporated. And so you start to get to see this positive reinforcement and a continuing ongoing shrinkage of the water body.
Unfortunately, what happened to Lake Chad also has happened to other parts of the global water body. Freshwater ecosystems are disappearing rapidly, at a much faster rate than other natural resources.
What this assessment has found is that freshwater ecosystems are disappearing very rapidly, at three times the rate of forests. And in fact, to the extent that we're now finding 12% of all wetlands are in fact human-made, if you count up all the dams, reservoirs, ponds, paddy fields, and so on. To some extent, that's starting to counterbalance the loss of natural freshwater ecosystems. But nevertheless, the protection of these freshwater ecosystems is becoming a top priority for all the services that they provide. We've found over 40 years, about 35% of wetlands been lost, and some 80% of freshwater species populations have declined, compared to 36% of coastal and marine species populations. So in fact, the freshwater ecosystems are being the most strongly impacted. And then here's a related issue, very important for climate change, is that peatlands as a form of wetland is actually a critical component of the carbon water cycle. In fact, peatlands contain at least the same amount of carbon as all the world's forests, if not more. Some assessments have indicated that it's up to twice as much carbon as all the world's forest. Emissions from drying of peatlands when they're being drained currently contribute about 5% of annual global carbon emissions. And we've found that about 15% of peatlands worldwide have been drained, and more are actively being drained every day. The solution is fairly straightforward. In technical terms, it's to re-wet the peatland so it turns from being a carbon source back into a carbon sink, where peatlands are actually absorbing carbon from the atmosphere and capturing it. Peatlands are essentially young coal fields. In many, many millions of years' time, that peat would become coal. But what we're doing is that we're destroying the world's peatlands at a very rapid rate. And this is a major issue for climate change.
Another key message emerging from the freshwater chapter of GO6 is that groundwater contains a much larger freshwater volume than surface water. And groundwater is increasingly important for water security in many countries and regions.
I'd like to turn now to groundwater, which is the other major freshwater component of about 30%. If you remember that I mentioned that about 70% of the world's freshwater is locked up in ice and snow, you'll see that in fact, the surface water that we have that is readily available in terms of lakes and rivers is a tiny percentage of the world's total freshwater. It's only about 0.3%. So the amount of groundwater that we have available worldwide is a whole order of magnitude larger, several orders, also orders of magnitude larger. And it's becoming increasingly important for many regions in terms of water security. The groundwater is an absolutely key instrument for us to use in good water management. And so integrated surface and groundwater management, I think, is really the watchword for the future. But we need much better monitoring and modeling of groundwater in order to support this new paradigm. And we particularly need good groundwater governance and management. Up to now, water governance and management has been mainly focused on these rather small freshwater resources that we have. So the emerging work being done on international water law for groundwater is absolutely crucial in this situation, and particularly in the case of the large transboundary aquifers, such as in North Africa and elsewhere.
When it comes to groundwater, what is the effective way of governance? When there is a conflict over transboundary groundwater between countries, for instance, how can such conflict be addressed?
One of the bottlenecks certainly is simply the process of international water law. You know, it took something like 20 years for the UN Watercourses Convention to come into effect. And the groundwater law only started being drafted, I think, much more recently than the Watercourses Convention. So it's simply a long process to get so many countries to come on board and to agree internationally. And then, as you say, the areas where there are transboundary aquifers are particularly, shall we say, a possibility for conflict. There's a lot that we still don't understand about groundwater. There needs to be a lot of investment in monitoring. We need to really understand the flow of groundwater, the rate of flow, what happens if groundwater is abstracted in one area, and how much does that affect another area, which could be many, many kilometers away, but on the same large aquifer. So all of these things on a particular aquifer would need to be negotiated. And it's so much harder if you think about how difficult transboundary water governance is on shared rivers, which you can see. and people can very clearly see how much water is flowing, if one country is retaining water upstream, for example, by building dams, and what the impact is downstream, that's quite clearly visible. So a lot of people have a good idea of what it is they're negotiating, that they're trying to reach agreement on. But in the case of groundwater, it's much more difficult to model. And then to get the technical results of that modeling across to the policymakers so they can understand what it is that they're actually negotiating over. It's a young discipline. I think it's growing very fast. But again, it's an area that needs substantially more investment and emphasis, I think, in terms of international water law.
Access to safe drinking water and sanitation is one important UN Sustainable Development Goal, or SDG. Everyone needs water to sustain their lives and, of course, maintain good hygiene. However, this is one of the SDGs that is badly off track, and this issue has a gender dimension as well. In developing countries, women tend to be the main water managers for their families, small gardens, and farms. But they're not the main water decision makers.
The good news that over 15 years from 2000 to 2015, 1.5 billion people gained access to basic drinking water services. The flip side of this is, however, the bad news that we still, in 2020, have about 2.3 billion people who don't have access to safe sanitation. So that is one of the SDGs that is badly off track. It was the one of the MDG targets that was off track back in 2015, and it's still off track. Every year we have 1.4 million people who die from pathogen-related diseases due to unsafe drinking water because of unsafe sanitation. And there's a gender dimension to this as well, because the bulk of water fetching in countries where the water distribution networks have not yet been sufficiently invested in falls on women and girls. And as you can see, women still spend 16 million hours per day collecting water in 25 sub-Saharan countries.
Did you know that the quality of water has significantly worsened since 1990? Poor water quality also has serious implications for our health and the health of our planet.
Water quality is unfortunately worsening worldwide. In Latin America and Africa, in Asia and Pacific region, about 50% of US waters don't meet water quality standards. Fortunately, over the last 20 years, water quality in Europe has improved due to the Water Framework Directive of the EU, which is implemented very strongly. And there's a lot of investment going into it as well. As I mentioned, pathogens remain a major cause of human death and illness, particularly in developing countries. It has been estimated that the total global disease burden could be cut by 10% by proper investment in water supply and sanitation. And this was before COVID-19. So I can't emphasize enough that water is a sector where there's significantly underinvested still. And finally, the eutrophication associated with nutrients and climate change also lead to more frequent algal blooms because of the higher temperatures. These cyanobacteria thrive in higher temperatures. We also find that mining causes acute water quality problems in many parts of the world.
GO6 also brings to light that today there are so many water contaminants, such as pharmaceuticals, pesticides, and macro, micro, and nanoplastics. Antibiotics reach the aquatic environment from a wide range of sources, such as treated and untreated human waste, agriculture, and animal husbandry. Antibiotic-resistant bacteria are now found in both source water and treated drinking water worldwide. And these endocrine-disrupting compounds are widely distributed through freshwater systems, which affects human and animal reproduction. As alarming as it sounds, well, isn't there a way to safely remove these toxic chemicals and plastics polluting fresh water?
Removing antibiotics as well. This is what we call refractory compounds. In other words, they're compounds that are actually very difficult to break down. most of the compounds in wastewater one can break down either aerobically or anaerobically. If you break them down anaerobically, you can actually produce methane, capture that methane and produce energy. So that's the wastewater energy conversion that I've been working on for a lot of my life. But these refractory compounds are really hard work. I think a major part of the investment right now has to go into source control and to try to stop these compounds as much as possible getting into the freshwater system in the first place. So, for example, much stricter controls on how people use antibiotics and what they do with those antibiotics, instead of flushing them down the toilet, that you actually have to return them to the pharmacy, for instance, that there's some sort of tracking process of how people use antibiotics. In the way that farms use antibiotics, that those antibiotics are kept on the farm and as much as possible in contained systems that can't get out into the freshwater system. In aquaculture, keeping those fish farms really separate from the natural water system so that the antibiotics that people are feeding the fish doesn't get into the water cycle. You know, the sort of source control involves a lot of regulatory measures. It's a lot of behavior change, so it's very difficult. But at the moment, to be honest, you know, there's a lot of effort going into that now through many, many governments worldwide. And also the FAO is doing a lot of work on these sorts of regulations. But in terms of wastewater treatment technologies, I think we're still a long way from finding the sort of technologies that are affordable worldwide to be able to remove both the endocrine disrupting compounds, the hormones, and the antibiotics from our wastewater.
So you'd better think again when you have the urge to flush your antibiotics in the toilet. Please don't do it. It'll contaminate the water, and there is no effective way to remove that completely once it's released into the water. For more details about what the freshwater chapter of GO6 contains, please be sure to check out the full GO6 report, available on the website of the UN Environment Program. We will also provide the link to this report on our podcast page. We hope you enjoyed this episode of The Evaluator by the Independent Evaluation Unit of the Green Climate Fund. We will be back with more insightful and interesting dialogues that matter for the evaluation and climate action communities. So, stay tuned! Remember to tweet your thoughts about the show with the hashtag TheEvaluator. Do you have questions for Dr. Anya Grobetsky? You can reach out to her on Twitter. Her handle is @AnyaGrobetsky1. We will also provide her Twitter handle on our podcast page. That's all for now. Signing off from the IEU headquarters in Songdo, Republic of Korea. Thank you for listening.